Hello and welcome to episode 209 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Lee Cox. Well, it seems like, Christopher, an absolute age since you and I were last together recording a podcast. How the heck are you?
I barely recognise you, frankly. It's a mysterious face at the other end of this internet connection that we have. I'm very well, thank you. And it's very nice to see you, Matt, because I was all on my own last week, as you know, and that was very frightening because I'm not normally allowed near the levers of power. But we managed to get a podcast out, and splendid guests Amy and Teresa were too. And then the week before, you were with Tom Standage, which was another really interesting conversation and something that, you know, another triumph. But yes, it's been a couple of weeks or, you know, 3 weeks or something, hasn't it?
It has. I do feel sorry. I know there's some in the audience who, because of efficiency and time saving, they have a tendency to be able to listen to the show at 1.5 speed or something. And I do feel sorry for them with Tom Standage because I don't think we've had a guest on the show who talks quite as quickly as Mr. S does. He is a phenomenal talker. Fantastic stuff to talk about, but he goes like the clappers.
Doesn't he? Doesn't he? Well, but still, you know, when you've got a lot to say, you may as well, you know, use all the time you've got as efficiently as you can.
Absolutely.
So then, given that it's been, well, a week since the listeners have heard you out there in podcast land, Matt, what have you been up to?
Well, the reason why I wasn't here last week, because I was up in Manchester at the Connected Futures event, which is a thing organised by Inside Housing, which is a trade journal in the housing sector. And I was chairing it all, and it was a one couple of days. It was a slightly scary start because Sunday, the week before last, if you remember, was Tree-mageddon, and there were basically no trains going out of London, King's Cross or Euston, because there were no trees left anywhere near a railway line anywhere in the general vicinity of Milton Keynes. So two attempted starts failed. Negotiation to be able to borrow the family car for 2 days. Eventually drove up and then had a very good couple of days in Manchester. Some really interesting themes came out. I've been inspired by the Welsh, the nation of Wales, in fact, that I hadn't realised, but the devolved administration in Wales have decided that 2050 is a ridiculously long time to set any target for anything. So they said, no, crack on, 2030 to be carbon neutral as a nation. And it's very noticeable how housing associations and other housing providers in Wales are cracking on rather than thinking that it's something that they don't need to worry about for a while. So that was very good. I got the chance to be able to interview the chair, no less, of the Parliamentary Select Committee on housing, Clive Betts MP from Sheffield. So that was interesting. And it was good. It was nice to be in person meeting people. It was nice doing that, but not having to worry about meetings and stuff. It really does bring home to me quite how pointless, and I'm sorry to say this as I know you're somebody who's been involved in the organisation of virtual events recently, but how pointless virtual events are, because if you're sitting at the same desk where you do meetings as well as you do events, then the ability to be able to focus on the event rather than just getting dragged into meetings is pretty much zip. Whereas if you are completely away in a different location, surrounded by people, and actually, in my case, on the stage for most of it because you're chairing the damn thing, it was a really good way to be able to not focus on anything other than the stuff that was going on at the event as well. So it was a very, very, very good couple of days, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. What have you been up to?
Well, I think I remember last week you said you went to Manchester and there was rain. I remember because I was coming back from Sheffield. I went to Sheffield to see some old friends and have one or two shandies, and managed to, I think my phone got broken on the way, and actually I wasn't entirely undamaged. It took quite a long time to recover, but I'm back now. I think just about, and I've been okay, right? Because we've got lots of I've been catching up with customers because I had a week off, and that's of course why you were on your own with Mr. Standage. I had a week off. I was on holiday for a week, so kind of catching up with what was going on work and re-engaging with customers and things like that. So I can't say I've done anything particularly exciting, Matt, that I can share with you that will provide you with any great insight or motivation or inspiration, really. It's just one of those things that I'm just glad to be alive, and you know, I got through a week, and of course,
excellent.
Last week was a splendid podcast with Teresa and Amy from AbilityNet, which is a really interesting organisation, and I urge anybody who hasn't managed to listen to last week's episode to get their ears around it.
Very good, it was too. Although, given the paucity of any sort of content in what you just said there, thank you, Chris. Very, very pleased that we're joined also this week.
I'll make a living, Matt. That's all I can say.
But you make a living, you scrape by. But yeah, no, we're joined this week by Lee Cox. Lee, how the devil are you? How's your last week been?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you, gentlemen. My last week has been good. So, yeah, so I'm a London cabbie. So it's been, the last 7 or 8 weeks have been very fruitful, which is lovely to see, because there's been no bugger around because they're furloughed or WFHing. So it was lovely. And so, in fact, today I was privy to the lovely cameras early this morning at Heathrow proclaiming that Marco Polo wasn't the first and you can all skip off to the US again. So, yeah, so lots more trips to the airport, which are really good. So, yeah, it just helps bolster things. So it's been really good. And
I think we should probably, for the listeners that don't know, should be able to put a bit of explanation there. And we'll talk about this in a bit more detail. But you are gainfully self-employed as a famous London black cab driver.
Indeed.
Is there truth in the rumours that I've been hearing recently that basically you have all now declared victory over the Ubers and you are winning?
Winning. I don't think the Uber thing is actually, it's not cut and dried. I think someone said that to me the other day, oh, aren't you? And I think the answer is that it's a small victory, but there's still a long way to go. And the reality always has been is that there's always been a huge amount more private hire vehicles than the black cabs. And, you know, it sounds a bit cliche, but I think the only way to kind of bounce against the competition is to just do your stuff really well. So, but yeah, there's always an Uber story. And Matt, there's always a very militant cab driver that you can speak to. Just get on the Twitters.
Yeah, I can well imagine. I mean, it's interesting to see how some of the unicorns going into the pandemic are looking somewhat droopy of single horn these days. And with obviously the demise of WeWork, but also a whole bunch of the sort of mobility as a service or whatever it was that they proclaimed themselves as, but basically just buying market share by subsidising fares or e-scooters or whatever else. It'd be interesting to see how much of that tech bubble that was in transport before pandemic actually rises again. I mean, because public transport, particularly the train service, is in absolute disarray. I think I saw something recently where commuter trains in the UK now are back to 40% of their pre-COVID capacity. Mm. It's just, you know, still tiny amounts of travelling going on in comparison to what was there before.
Yeah, I mean, there's on the surface, and that's both a cliche, but it is a bit of a pun, but on the surface, it looks like a lot of people. But yeah, I think the whole kind of hybrid working thing is going to take a while to sort of settle down. But yeah, there's anecdotally so many, there's only really the handful of the, you know, Goldman, Bloomberg and JP Morgan, and everybody else is accepting that it'll be a few days a week. So
yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see how that then pans out into a whole swathe of areas. We work are now starting to look in a bit more depth about what hybrid means. There was a day last week where there were quite a lot of, probably the most people we've had back in the office at any given time, because there was a Diwali and fireworks celebration at the office in that evening. And we still got a long way to go to be able to work out what provision you need to make and what services you need to have available and what space you make available to people and how you do that and still have people working out of the office. And it's, yeah, still in the foothills of it feels to me at the moment.
Sorry, no, I just think ironically that actually, you know, for those that can kind of hold on to their reins, you know, the cab trade will possibly benefit from the shakedown in terms of, if you've got people that are only doing 3 days, 2 days averse to five, they're coming in, they have quote unquote a bit more expendable cash, so they may be more inclined to take a cab. And then you've also got people that will still want to not go on the tube and, you know, jump in the cab and go, well, that I feel better for that. So that could be actually a sort of a benefit. But yeah, it's one of the many things to sort of shake out and see what happens and what kind of how it balances out.
Is there anything from the world of IDC about any of this stuff that's fresh, or are they still plodding away at?
Well, I mean, everybody's really looking at the research and the data that came out during sort of many lockdowns and the first reaction to COVID in different countries. But all the data that we see so far is that, you know, kind of hybrid sticking, right? It just is going to be the way. And a bit like Lee said, that there are some companies that are saying they're off everybody back to where you belong. But they're probably the companies where those people, the people who they would consider very valuable and, you know, indispensable in terms of they're not, you know, you don't want to lose them for any length of time, would never get on the tube anyway. They'd travel by taxi. They're not going to be hemmed in with all of the super spreaders. So
they're not traveling in from zone six.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So I would say that on the whole, across the world, I mean, all the data we're seeing suggests that hybrid and remote is definitely here to stay. But, you know, that's what people are saying at the moment. And they're saying it for lots of perfectly good reasons, partly because everybody's got used to a way of working and the FD is getting quite excited about getting rid of a few building leases. And there's a feeling, you know, there's a whole great resignation thing. There's lots. I mean, really, the technology companies particularly are absolutely terrified that they're losing people. So they're not going to make a unpopular decision on the whole to say, everybody, you know, get on the train and get back in. However, I have a sneaking suspicion that the elastic is a bit stronger than we think it is, that there'll be a more of a pull once everything settles down a bit, assuming it does settle down a bit, and we'll see more people return to the office than current predictions say. But, you know, the elastic has been stretched beyond its limit. It's not going back to how it was, but... Mm. But yeah, I mean, at the moment, everybody's saying, no, this is how it is, but we'll see.
It was notable, actually, at the event in Manchester that those organisations that had the biggest geographic dispersal, so there's some housing associations who are massive and they cover the whole length of the country, or they're massive because they cover a big geographic area. It's like Yorkshire Housing, 100 miles by 100 miles. And it definitely felt that those ones that are already geographically dispersed have taken the opportunity in many cases already to go, right, we can sell the head office. We don't need to have that. We can have regional hubs. We don't need to have people coming into specific places. Hybrid's the way forward. We've made some decisions about it. And for those that are more compact in terms of the geography that they serve, so they weren't really working necessarily in sort of virtual ways beforehand, there's a bit more of a reticence. And the interesting thing about that is that for those that are more conservative in their view about what they will do with hybrid in the future, they've just entered into an employment market with specialist skills is now the whole country. And that's the bit, because if you've got big players who are willing to say, no, you can work from wherever, that will impact every employer in a particular sector. And that's where it starts to get interesting. I do, though, think that we will see in the future, for some organisations, for some sorts of people, the idea of a fixed desk in an office, not hot desk, your desk, your own desk in an office every day available will become a perk. And that's something I've argued for a while with the kind of emergence of hot desking over the last 10 years or so. But yeah, all sorts of strange to still come, I reckon. Anyway, with that, I think we should get on with the meat of the show and we'll talk about career change. So let's crack on.
In 2020, there was an ad on the TV, on billboards and whatnot, about young Fatima, who was a ballerina, and the government was suggesting that maybe she didn't know that her next job was going to be in cyber. That advert was eventually pulled, I gather, because of a bit of a backlash about it. But it was an interesting view on how people change roles or how they go from one skill to another. And we've got Lee here to talk about that today, because that's exactly what's going on, right?
Yeah. So I suppose if I start at the beginning, because as Mary Poppins said, it's a very good place to start. So I literally fell into container shipping. I did a week when I was 19 covering someone on holiday. Container leasing, I'd never heard, you know, had a small grasp on what shipping was, and essentially can you stay another week, can you stay another week, and it was good fun and it was interesting, and you know, and I stayed in the industry for 19 years, and I did you know, lots and lots of stuff. I worked in a very it's a very small, still is a very small industry with a lot of people doing very kind of, it's very interconnected, you know, as you might expect with shipping, you know, very simple business at its heart, but all the different nuts and bolts involved and big boxes, little boxes and that go with cardboard boxes. And so I then progressed to work for the shipping lines themselves. So poacher turned gamekeeper, whatever that idiom is. And I did, you know, a phenomenal amount of operational logistic work, traveled, you know, I always say that it was kind of a pseudo business degree because I'd learned a lot about geography, trade flows, all of that actually on the job. And it was a fascinating industry. And, you know, I've got such fond memories of it and loads of really great friends still dotted all around the world. So I did that for 19 years. And then I did the not unusual thing of marrying and having kids. And I kind of plateaued where I was in shipping. And I'll try not to use too many puns, but I kind of missed the boat in terms of getting that job and that job. And because it is quite small and, you know, it's you know, there are things don't come up that often. And you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles. So I decided that because we weren't living in a world where hybrid working and flexibility was quite as, although it doesn't seem that long ago, but you know, it wasn't quite as accepted. So I thought I need to do something different to have a bit more flexibility. Bumped into a mate of mine that I knew for donkey's years that had been a cab driver, and he didn't sell me the Dick Whittington, the streets are paved with gold. He said, you know, it's a decent job. You get to call the shots. You get to decide when you do and don't work. You know, don't think you're going to end up with a fortune, but you know, it's a decent thing. So I went off and did the knowledge. And if I'm honest, the knowledge was probably, in terms of where I'm now, the knowledge is probably the thing that did it for me. Because what it did is it gave me that job as a cab driver. It forced me to study like I'd never studied before. It's a very solitary thing. It's a very, you know, you spend a year and a half more or less before you even step in front of a examiner and they say, take me from here to A to Z. Yeah, so it's a very, you know, you have to, it kind of forces you to become disciplined. And, you know, they maintain that there's something along the lines of about 70 to 80% of people that started don't finish it. So I did that. Then I became a cab driver and enjoyed that for a while. And then I kind of got restless because all of that learning you do as a cab driver, you almost stagnate. It's a bit, you know, the best cab driver, they're all great, but the best cab driver, like a car, is the comparison is, you know, a car's MOT is valid until you drive off the forecourt. And the best cab driver is the cab driver until they get their badge. Because until that point, you're learning all of the, you know, you're covering all of it in case you might get asked one of these myriad of places, you know, take me from this place, take me to that place. And because it all has to be, it's all an oral examination. You know, you've got to have it all in your head, and you're constantly revising, and you're a highly tuned machine of knowledge. And parts of that drop off, and also that parts of you that need to be constantly learning and knowledge gaining, you know, hippocampus also go. So I got restless, and I'd always wanted to do a degree, and I thought, what can I do now? And my kids got a bit older, and you know, I still wanted the flexibility. So I thought, well, I know I'll do a degree. And I was going to do an English a teaching degree. Had to do English, maths, and science. Really liked English. Aced my English, ironically, in the year when all the grades were being screwed about, but managed to pull an A star out. Not managed, obviously. I was wonderful. But then I thought, well, I'll go and do English. So I did an English degree with the OU, which took me 4 years, and you know, had to pull on the same kind of skills of learning. It was more difficult because my kids were older, so I had to sit and listen to, you know, Hans Zimmer got me through, basically, you know, sort of soundtracks while I kind of read and did essays, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I then, and I picked English because it's always been like my kind of favorite subject. I love words, love learning words. Get bored if I don't sort of find a new one each day. So it's rather nice to sort of check in with Susie Dent on Twitter as to what she's got going. And then I was kind of hunting around for a teacher training position. So again, this sort of speaks to the kind of the greater thing about being a cab driver is you're exposed to a lot of different people at different points. Not exposed, sorry, take that back. But you are in the presence of different people, and you are, you know, if you so decide, you can have amazing conversations. You know, Hungarian professors of economics, you know, wives of Prince Edward, all sorts of stuff at various points. So you can, you know, and I happened to pick up some, and they were rushing to somewhere, and they worked for a big school federation, and I said what I was thinking about doing, and I'd actually been looking at doing primary, but I wasn't getting, couldn't get arrested for doing that, not doing that, but you know, I couldn't get myself a position to train in primary, so I spoke to these people, and they said, well, look, you know, we, why don't you come along to one of these open days? Went along to the open day, and you know, night turns to day, and I'm then secured a place to train English, train teaching English at a secondary school. So dropped the cab back, start doing that. And then basically things kind of fell apart a bit, really. We both my wife and I had lost a parent in the year before that. Our youngest son had awful bullying. And I've done a lot of things. I've, you know, the comparison of so we've all seen, we all know it's not an easy gig being a teacher, and we know that there's a lot of, you know, you're up against kind of at its best resistance and, you know, sort of oppositional to even a great extent. And it's a bit like the band, you know, you're like the Blues Brothers playing in the country club doing Rawhide, you know, they're not interested. So all of that happened, and, you know, so I'm in a position where I'm really just not coping with it. And it was hard to decide that I really couldn't carry on, because despite all the time I'd given into it and some of the enjoyment I've got from it, it wasn't conducive to my kind of lifestyle. So I came back to the cab. So I came back to the cab at the end of 2019, and it was all rocking and rolling really quite nicely. Picked up an electric cab, best thing since sliced bread was sliced, and then the pandemic hits. So I spend 6 months thinking about the shipping stuff, and equally that was tough getting back into that. And then I'd heard you guys on the podcast, I'd heard a friend of mine, Sharon O'Dea, on the podcast, and then as I do follow people on Twitter, and we, you know, you and I had a conversation, Matt, and then I spent the last 7 months pursuing digital in earnest, and here we are.
Here we are indeed.
Here we
so
are.
So you, I mean, that's something of a journey in terms of your various decisions that you've made based on, I guess opportunistic, really. It's just something that's come along. You fell into shipping, somebody approached you, or, you know, you had a conversation about cabbing, you had a conversation about, you know, you wanted to do a degree and that came along. So some of it's been sort of directed and some of it's been opportunistic. And I guess, would you say digital is the same, in as much as that's where everybody is now? So doesn't that make sense to be in that?
Yeah, it does. I think it's also, you know, I've kind of been on the periphery of people that have been in the digital world for about 10 years and kind of known what they do, but not really know what they do. So, you know, Dominic Campbell that co-set up FutureGov, I had a conversation with Dominic, and I just, so they're, yeah, opportunistic, but driven by where I am now. You know, I was 19 and, you know, just fell into shipping. I didn't care what I did, I earned the job, but actually, wow, this is a great environment. You know, I'm then 33, 34, and want to get into something else because, you know, I've got kids, and how, you know, what's the best thing for me to be in now? And I'd breached the plateau. And then, you know, again, the knowledge kind of set me on the path of thinking, oh, actually, you know, if you knuckle down and learn stuff, you can get places, or you can engineer yourself into a position which you are then, you know, suitable to do these different things. And I just think, you know, so what I've got now is a big bag of all of that, and such a lot of it is generic, you know, and plus the additional kind of life skills that you get from kind of approaching the big 5-0.
And maybe that's, I think that's one of the things that puts people off in terms of when they're thinking about, well, am I going to be doing this that I'm doing now forever? It's not so much that they don't think they can do something else, but there's a big sort of delta, a big jump through a period of learning and proving oneself that is quite daunting, right? And I guess the fact that you did that with the knowledge, which is one of the, it's a very difficult thing to do, and as you say, a lot of people try and fail.
Mm.
Once you've done that, I guess, you know, you feel, well, if I've done that once, I can do it again in any kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I mean, we all, if we're a certain age, know of Fred Housego, who's, you know, famous London cab driver, went on and won Mastermind.
I used to deliver his newspaper. Can I just put that out there? I used to deliver Fred Housego's newspaper.
So you furnished him with all that kind of, like, kind of, yeah. You know, exactly. There we go. So Fred, you know, and so Fred Housego... me are in, I know we love Venn diagrams, are in that Venn diagram of other cab drivers that have gone off and gone, you know, hey, look, I'm really good at this learning lark and I like it and I'm going to go off and do something else. You know, I mean, there's another study that's going on at UCL, which they're now, it's wonderful actually. I mean, I've got in a drawer somewhere, I've got a scan of my brain because I took part in a study about 9 years ago, I suppose, and they've just done another one, Hugo Spears at UCL, and they're going, well, we can use some of this to kind of tackle dementia, and that isn't that just a marvelous thing? So yeah, I think I clearly have a gift for retaining information, and I enjoy that, the furtherment of knowledge, and that's led me onto the other things I've done, plus that coupled with, you know, like everybody needing to earn a crust, and you know, and I think that's the thing that holds, as you said, Chris, that's the thing that holds a lot of people back is, crikey, I've got a mortgage, I've got kids, I can't just go and change. And you know, it's, I suppose maybe we're not yet at a place in society where it's accepted that not only can you do it, that actually for the better, the furtherment of us all, the more kind of quality of a society that we can all enjoy is if we are able to do it, you know, comfortably. I needed the OU degree because I've got a student debt, you know, so that's, you know, and that was afforded to me because of what we already have. So that's, you know, that was, but I had to take that on and accept that was a cost. But I think in the long term, it's worthwhile doing.
There's quite a lot within the ability to be able to change that is, I guess, dependent on taking on real risk, isn't there? And, you know, I guess... becoming a cab driver through the route of the knowledge is a bit unusual in that I imagine it is mostly people. It's not people's first job. So you don't at 17 get your driving license and then sign up for the knowledge.
No, there's a
people
few.
Who've done things before. But that's relatively rare, and having a kind of, God, there's so many puns in this, but having a kind of structured on ramp to how you can go into something that is new. And it's a relatively, I mean, you know, being a licensed cab driver in London is a fairly uncommon sort of profession in the regulated, you know, it's there with doctors, vets and architects and whatever, and the idea of you have to go through a certain set of accreditation and then you have to be able to maintain that accreditation over time because digital's not like that. I mean one of the ironies is I don't think there's anybody other than how well they sell their CV who's got any accreditation to do any of it. It's all, you know,
yeah,
and the antithesis of a protected profession.
Although someone's told me I should go and get a Scrum Master certificate, so you know, I don't know, I get it. I don't. I mean, I was a bit worried at first because I don't know. I haven't got the first clue about the rugger ball, but yeah. But it's interesting. Yeah, it's been interesting, kind of having different conversations with different people and kind of finding that, you know, yeah. There's a gap to be bridged of, you know, lots of that stuff that you need to successfully operate. I mean, I wouldn't just say in digital, I would say in any number of organizations where you have to interact with other people and you know, processes it's kind of making that final step.
There's something about, I think, so from my experience of doing consulting work, I mean, when I was doing freelance work, I made a point of not being focused on any particular industry sector because I couldn't be that fussy in many ways. But also, I was also really fascinated by the idea of actually being able to work across many different sectors. And there's something about that at core, most businesses are essentially, at its simplest form, the same thing. They take something, they do something to it to make it more valuable, and they sell it on at a premium to be able to meet the needs of the customer who is willing to pay a premium for the value add that they put into it. And whether you're selling mobile phone networks or, I don't know, consulting services in wastewater or law or whatever else, and sort of randomly thinking through some of the clients I had, that thing is the same. And yet every sector will say we're very different to any other.
Yeah.
And the thing that actually I think I've worked out over the years is the thing that's different is the language, not the business model underpinning it. It's still just add value to thing and sell it at a premium. But, and it's, I guess to some extent, it's about your ability, one's ability to be able to pick up the language of a new sector or a new profession quickly to be able to show the credibility in that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've been trying to convince people, you know, my story is that I'm looking at doing delivery in this area, and my delivery has been a thread through everything from delivering containers to delivering education to kids, and in all of those sectors, and delivering people in cabs, and in all of those sectors you have a story to tell, or a process to follow through, and they all demand that you listen to the people that you're working with, and that you understand it, and that you can distill that as quickly as possible and then act on it. And you know, when you speak to most people, that is essentially what it is. It's just a case of, you know, if you're able, it's being willing enough to open yourself to those different things, and to be able to kind of, you know, quickly but efficiently percolate the ideas, and then off. But I think it sounds a cliche, but you know, anybody can change job. You've got to really want to do it. You know, you've got to really want to be a cab driver to be able to complete knowledge, right? It's not impossible. You have to find your own way. There is no, they talked about it once, but there is no city in guilds. There is no BTEC in being a cab driver, you know. Apart, I mean, you could sort of say in the digital world, there are sort of short courses to do, but you need to have those core kind of aptitudes and mindsets and all of that to perform the job. Because I mean, somebody shared something on LinkedIn the other day, and someone said, you know, when you see these jobs advertised, you know, they want the preformed person. That, you know, I can't remember the phrase, but essentially, look at your job description, and how much of that could you teach? I'm not paraphrasing this very well, but you know, what could you teach a switched on person, an attentive person, a focused person, all of that, you know? And if it's then that surely widens your net. And yeah, it's, I mean, this phrase leap of faith, I've used it before, and it's not probably correct, but it's I don't know, a leap of trust, maybe, I don't know, rather than leap of faith, is what employers should be able to do a bit more. I don't know.
Since with the various skills gaps that we have in the economy at the moment, and given the, I guess, the potentially less attractive nature there is for people to travel to the United Kingdom for work these days because of what we've done over the last few years, to put it out, that actually being able to get people to be able to switch between careers and retrain is going to be more important going forward than it ever has been. I think it always has been important. From what you've experienced this time around and what you've experienced when you've changed things in the past, what sort of support do you think people who want to change careers could do with? What are the things that maybe you've had, or maybe the things you haven't had?
Yeah,
if only there'd been that there for me.
I think there almost needs to be like an arm of a Citizens Advice Bureau. You know, I've got a crap electricity supply. I mean, you can go to U-Switch, but you know, there needs to be. I hate the phrase safe space because it sounds, but there needs to be a space in which people can make those connections. You know, I don't think you can underestimate the, you know, beyond that desire to do it, I've used the Twitter and social media and more latterly LinkedIn and just been willing to have conversations and you know, once you start the ball rolling, you know, it's like a sort of it can be a snowball effect, and I think that's what people need. That you need to have a mentor if you're in a new job. You almost need a mentor to get your new job. So it's that kind of service which I think would be useful. And I think that's in many ways probably best served from people that have to be able to kind of pay that back. But yeah, I think that's the sort of thing that would be useful, is to have some kind of accessible forum or you know, groups or whatever it is to sort of latch yourself onto and to go from there.
But I think, I mean, and I think that's a really good point. And having people who can almost give you the confidence to say, actually, yeah, there are these things you can learn, and these things are more difficult or whatever. But also, I think it's employers too, right? It's people who are hiring, or hiring managers, as we might call them in the trade. There's a real reticence to hire inexperienced because that's seen as a risk, right? And people would seem to me, it seems to be less risky for managers to hire an experienced idiot than an inexperienced smart person, because it's not always, you know, people succeed at work sometimes, some people sort of fail at work sometimes, and it's not always their own fault. Some people succeed despite themselves, and some people fail even though they've done everything right, really. Because work's complex. It's all about relationships. You can be lucky, you can be unlucky, things happen. I've seen bad people succeed, and I've seen good people fail. So when they fail and somebody asks the question as to why they failed, it's far easier for somebody to point at, oh, well, they didn't have any experience, because that's kind of measurable. It's back to this kind of obsession about measuring things to say, look, that person didn't have any experience, so now you're in trouble because you hired them, rather than that person was an idiot or it was a dick, and therefore they dropped the ball. But that's not your fault, is it? You know, because what a dick. You know, I wish I hadn't hired that person. Right? I did all my checks. Yeah, but you still hired a dick. This is the problem. You get into more trouble for hiring somebody with an experience than you do for hiring a dick. And that's the trouble. My view, and I've done this before, and sometimes I've got it wrong. Very, very rarely, actually. Most of the time, you know, this whole thing about, you know, I hire for attitude before experience and all that kind of thing. Well, most of the time that really works, right? Because if you hire somebody who really wants to work and is diligent, and who can learn, who wants to learn, generally speaking, as long as you're not asking them to go and perform a, you know, an ear operation the next day, or, you know, you need to be, this is the art of management. In fact, there was a conversation today about this on the WB40 group. It's somewhat different subject, but the question about how do you make sure that people don't act out of a conflict of interest and things like that. And it's management. It really is. It's about evaluating people, about where are their strengths, where are their weaknesses, what are they going to be exposed to? Is it going to matter? How quickly can they learn? What can they afford to get wrong? And this is it's a bit of an art, and it's something that we miss in this kind of obsession to measure. But yeah, I mean, I've taken off slightly a bit of an angle there, but I think that those things that can give you confidence and show you what you can learn and what you can afford to get away with and what you can't afford to get away with, and having those experienced people to guide you, brilliant. But hiring managers that can manage rather than just going by the books, gosh, if we had more of those, please.
Yeah. I mean, it's a box ticking exercise, which is frustrating, because you need to know. You said before about language in different areas, Matt, and it's kind of like that, really. You know, there's certain things that you buzzwords you have to say, or you know, and it's tiring. You know, job applications are, you know, if you're truly committed to trying to get that job, or you think you're the right person, you can spend hours on those things, and yeah, it's if it's just going to be looked at and kind of scanned for words, you think, oh, you know, what's the point of that, really?
There is something about how CVs have now become basically an exercise in search engine optimization. And so my own career background is, it makes, when you talked about, you know, your experience since leaving school, that actually it makes sense chronologically like that, but it doesn't make sense going backwards. And for me as well, I think, you know, the story of a career is something that only makes sense chronologically in hindsight, and yet we have the rules that is your CV starts in the most recent position first, and with automatic candidate tracking systems, the first sort will be done by a machine that's looking for keywords, which is, we've got to a point where actually we're stripping out any opportunity for anybody who isn't just exactly what you've asked for to come through. The problem is, if you go, and this is, you know, I've had this conversation with recruiters over many years, most of the time when most people are going out to market with a job advert, it's because they have defined something that is extremely difficult to find. Yeah. And that's usually a problem of the role definition, not the lack of available people in their organisation. It's a problem of lack of imagination, not, you know, a fact that they don't necessarily have the correct current capabilities within. People look for unicorns when it comes to the recruitment processes. And if they're already looking for something that's impossible, being able to think about how they might be able to reposition that in a way that could be, you know, enable somebody to be retrained for it, whether internally or externally, is, it's a, that feels like hard into nothing.
The thing about it as well is that I think the other downside to that, and this is what I think a lot of people, I don't know, I sometimes feel I'm an oddity, but I don't want to go into a job that I know back, because the knowledge, for a start, is when you are, when you get your badge after however many years, you're still not a complete cab driver. There's still a bit of like on the job learning, because you know you can go the shortest route every, you know, but you know when you actually hit the real world, and you know, rather like a drunk hitting the pavement, the oxygen will hit you and you go, actually I can't do that because it doesn't work, and I will be sitting in traffic and it's no good be said, but Mr. Swire said it was the quickest route on the map, they won't give a carrot. And it's, you know, if you're trying to, if you know, if you want to get somebody in that already knows it all, I just think There's a double-edged sword. I mean, my two kids have been knocked back for sort of very menial, not menial, sorry, but for retail jobs because they're quote unquote unqualified. And you know, you run into the proposition of employing somebody that knows it backwards. And what are they there for? You know, what are they getting from it, and what are you getting from them? What, how are you? And also, you know, the thing I'm trying to get into is. Going in and going, what are we doing here then? And asking a difficult question and asking a stupid question. And again, a stupid question is only a stupid question if you don't know the answer. Well, it's not, no, sorry, no, it's not a stupid question if you don't. You know, a stupid question is, you know, it's almost a phrase that should be banned. Everybody should be able to ask a question, and you should be able to get somebody into a position that you, they can grow, you can grow them, you can take the elements of their experience and personality and makeup that will make them suited for the role, and then that role should then evolve, could then evolve into something else. And with so many kind of processes and places being quite generic, you know you can benefit from somebody that comes into one industry from another and goes, oh, we don't do it like that over there. And it's not, because unless it is rocket science, it isn't rocket science. That's what annoys, that's the thing that I kind of keep boring myself with.
And there's the cliche that I have heard again and again and again, which is organisations saying, we want to be really innovative, could you show us somebody who's done it before, please?
Oxy, show me my moron. Yeah.
Indeed. And it's, yeah, it's basically, there's this obsession, I think, in most organisations about trying to be able to remove all risk. And it what it misses is the fact that you actually, your business will only expand and grow and prosper if you take risks rather than just avoiding them all the time. Well, there's probably a deeper cultural problem there.
Well, you speculate to accumulate, right? I don't know who said that, but you know, and big oaks from little acorns grow, and all of that. You know, my mother told me, I think, I don't know, but as well as, you know, brush your teeth before you go to bed. But you know, I don't know. It's interesting because I think there's a lot of people, there's a lot of really good people that are doing the wrong and are capable of doing a brilliant job somewhere else. And yeah, my heart aches a bit for people that haven't got the confidence to go and do that. And like you say, Matt, is, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was a space, if there was like a, you know, a kind of, I don't know, B&Q for job change.
Lee, thank you for sharing all of that, actually. And we will keep a close eye on how it all goes. I think you have some irons in fires at the moment that sound like they might be promising, which is all good, but we won't tempt fate with any of that. But a week ahead, what is in store for Mr. Cox?
Mr. Cox has a couple of pre-booked jobs with people that helped me out over the pandemic. So I'm repaying the journey there with taking some people to some hospital appointments. And yeah, generally kind of just sort of keeping myself abreast of stuff, finishing off Bob Mortimer's most excellent And Away autobiography, which is absolute manna for the soul. So yeah, and being tip-top cabbie.
Excellent. And Chris, what are you up to for the weekend?
Well, that's a good question. This week I am mainly ploughing my way through catching up with work. And at the moment I've got what would I call it? It's a bit of a theme because of various things I'm doing for different customers around value of IT. So it seems to be something that we're all asked to do from time to time in this kind of job is to re-justify what you do and why you do it. But one or two of the conversations I've had recently have shed a bit more light onto it, really, about how you can kind of measure it. And even those things that aren't measurable, how can you put something around it to help articulate that? Because technology is so fundamental now, you know, it's not something you can just dispense with. But, you know, how do you stop it becoming, you know, squeezed and squeezed and squeezed until it's the least, you know, the tiniest and most, you know, the least it can possibly be. So, no, some people might say that's not a bad thing. But anyway, that's what I'm doing. It's quite interesting. It's getting the creative juices flowing. What about you, Matt?
I'm very excited about it. I can't remember if I mentioned this on the show before, but because of a few shifts around with medical appointments, on Wednesday night, I'm going to be a VIP guest at the 30th Student Radio Award. I've been invited because 30 years ago, I helped set up the Student Radio Association whilst I was doing my degree at Loughborough.
Is that right? I don't think you've ever mentioned that before.
Really? Yeah, but I have. But anyway, I'm very excited because I'm going to be... you're too kindly. And I tell you what, it's the O2 on Wednesday night, and I am pretty much certain I am going to be the oldest person in the room. And I reckon I'm going to last about 2 hours before the sheer misery of being old will overcome me and I will leave. But I'm so looking forward to it and to get to meet hopefully some of the recent chairs of the Student Radio Association, including Danny, who's the current one, who's invited me along. So that's going to be good. And then just to kind of offset that, at the weekend, going down to Brighton to celebrate a friend of mine's 50th birthday. So, yeah, all ends of the age spectrum encompassed within the space of about 5 days. So, yeah, all good. So there we go. I think that's it for another week then. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And next week we are going to be talking security with somebody who used to advise and work for the Estonian government about said matters. So that should be an entertaining little interlude. Until then, Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir. Chris, thank you, Chris.
Good to see you again. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome back, Matt.
And we will be back again next Monday for another episode of WB40.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.